want the mission, we want the crowd loud. Fist pumping, rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want. We want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Peter Phillips will be back next week. On today's show, In Our Power, U.S. Students Organize for Justice in Palestine. We'll be joined for the hour by author and journalist Nora Barrows-Friedman. We'll be discussing her book of the same name, out this week on Just World Books. We are also joined by Kumars Salehi, PhD student in German studies at the University of California, Berkeley, who is also a member of Students for Justice in Palestine. Today on the program, an hour talking about Israel, Palestine, and U.S. policy, especially looking at students organizing for justice in Palestine. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. This week, we interview for the hour author and journalist, editor, radio broadcaster, musician, and hip mama, Nora Barrows-Friedman, whose new book is just out called In Our Power. And this is a book about U.S. students organize for justice in Palestine. So we're going to talk to Nora Barrows-Friedman for the hour. Nora is recipient of numerous journalistic awards. She is associate editor of the electronic Intifada, which is an award-winning and widely acclaimed independent online publication that focuses on Palestine and Palestinian rights. And of course, Project Censored has been no stranger to covering those issues over the years, given that they are extremely censored or biased and framed in U.S. corporate media. Nora has contributed to Project Censored over the years and, in fact, was one of our board members until very recently at the Media Freedom Foundation. Nora, you join us today in studio. Thanks so much for taking time out.
Thanks, Mickey.
So, Nora, let's talk a little bit about your publisher, Just World Books, Helena Coban. For the listeners out there that might recognize that, it's really an amazing small independent publisher. And how did you connect with Helena and Just World Books?
Over the years, covering Palestine and Middle East politics, culture, and analysis for the Electronic Intifada, Helena, when she would have a new book out, she and I would meet for coffee and we would chat about the new books and the importance of publishing these titles. She focuses a lot on really radical analysis about U.S. foreign policy in the context of the Middle East, Palestine in particular, Iran, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria. And so she and I just developed a really sweet friendship, and she had always said, you know, when are you going to do your book? And I would laugh and laugh. Oh, I don't have time to do a book. But about a year and a half ago, she came back to Berkeley. We went out for coffee and she said, you know, you've been doing such incredible reporting on the student movement here in the U.S., you know, for Palestine solidarity activism. I really think you should do this book now. And she basically offered me a contract on the spot and I got to work really shortly after. And now I have a book about students doing incredible organizing for Palestine solidarity.
And that's just such a fantastic subject. And of course, at Project Censored, we work with hundreds of students and scores of professors every year on our annual volumes. And that's really one of several things that really stood out to me about your project. One was that it was so focused on students and youth. Not that all students are young and youthful, but youthful at heart, perhaps. But certainly a lot of the people you talked to were young people that were incredibly engaged by the injustices taking place in an apartheid Israel-Palestine. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that here, obviously, this hour. The other thing that jumps out, too, about this book, In Our Power, U.S. Students Organize for Justice in Palestine, by our guest, Nora Barrows-Friedman, is you have an incredible narrative style, right? It's very readable, and it really puts the reader in the context of how these exciting things are taking place and this resistance is taking place. And tell us a little bit about the foreword. Tell us a little bit about that, because that really sets the stage for a lot of the tone that comes through the book.
Yeah, the foreword was written incredibly by Noura Erekat, who's one of the most iconic figures in the movement and was a part of the inception of Students for Justice in Palestine at UC Berkeley. She is a human rights lawyer. She's a mentor to a lot of students who are organizing now across the U.S. on college campuses. She wrote this really brilliant and moving forward for the book about what it was like being an activist at UC Berkeley right after 9/11 as Israel was massacring people in the first few months of the First Intifada. And then really what it was like after the 2005 Palestinian-led call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions, which really kind of centered and focused the entire international movement for Palestine solidarity and Palestinian rights, you know, into this really powerful, concrete structure around which organizers, activists, students could really focus and do some incredible concrete changes toward justice in Palestine. And today I brought in the studio with me Kumar Salehi, who's a PhD student and active member of Students for Justice in Palestine at Cal. And so, you know, to go from the really beginnings of this SJP coalition and to see it be transformed a decade later is really incredible and moving and inspiring. And now we have like over 140, 150 different chapters of Students for Justice in Palestine around the country. And here at Berkeley was really one of the main places of that.
And that's really remarkable, particularly given that there's been pushback on some of the campuses and even in California, there was pushback to try to legally challenge the existence of organizations on public campuses that criticize the state of Israel.
Yeah. And not just legally challenge, but try and really actively stifle academic freedom and debate and discussion on one of the most important human rights topics of our time.
It was a disgusting act of censorship, in fact. And we see those around the country, like with what's happening in Illinois with Professor Salita.
Oh, yeah.
There's an onslaught, really, to try to silence anybody that dares speak. Well, you know, if you look at some of the work of purportedly revered civil libertarians, right, like Nelson Mandela and others, I mean, these people called out and said, look, the apartheid situation in Palestine and Israel-Palestine, that's the core of global injustice.
Right.
It's interesting that, you know, people like to show up at Nelson Mandela's funeral and take selfies like President Obama, but they don't really want to go to the core of what many activists around the world have long pointed a finger at, as this is a major issue, and to ignore it means we're never really going to have, you know, global stability and peace in a lot of ways.
Right. And it's really disturbing, I think, to put it mildly, that university administrations are not interested in cultivating discussion and debate on campus. And they would much rather be beholden to their donors and outside political organizations who don't want to see Israel be criticized on campus and Israeli apartheid be the focus of so much activism.
And I'm going to say this right now at the beginning, you know, toward the beginning of our conversation here. This is in no way about anti-Semitism. We regularly hear that any critique of Israel and that these student movements are somehow anti-Semitic, they're against Jewish people and culture, and that's a gross distortion and straw person fallacy that's used against these people.
Absolutely, and it's been one of the ways in which these outside political organizations have been trying to suppress this activism by conflating Judaism with Zionism. And then by that account, any criticism of Zionism or Zionist policy or Israeli policy is automatically seen as an act of anti-Semitism, when in fact there are so many Jewish students rallying and organizing against Zionism and against Israeli policies. Of course, this has nothing to do with Judaism or Jewish people or Jewish culture. It has to do with settler colonialism and with the control of an indigenous population under a foreign settler population and the militarism and the extreme segregation and discrimination that goes on by Israel against Palestinians.
It's, again, a riveting set of developments that we see around this issue. It's as if we can't have sober discourse around this subject in the United States. And that's too bad. But we, of course, certainly have many students to thank. And you say 140, 150 groups now across
at
the
least.
U.S. That are really pushing for this dialogue and to have it.
Right.
And what better place to have it than in educational institutions where the purpose of the dialogue is you know, educational. And I know that some of the blurbs on your book include prominent Jewish voices, right, for peace and dialogue on these issues. So I just wanted to get that out of the way because anytime we do a show on these issues, that's the phones are ringing off the hook and hate mail flies in. And I hope that those people will maybe just listen, you know, and hear that there really isn't anything hateful happening in our dialogue.
No, I mean, it's an issue of universal justice and human rights. There's nothing about bigotry or hatred of a certain group.
There isn't. In fact, again, one of the people blurbing the book here, Rebecca Vilcomerson, executive director of Jewish Voice for Peace, you know, again, lauds the work, lauds your book. Again, it's just out right now. In Our Power, we're talking with author and journalist Nora Barrows Friedman. Her book is now out on Just World Books. Let's go into a little bit of the sort of the history here and then come up to the present, certainly to the students. And then, since you did mention earlier, we do have with us in studio also Kumars Salehi, PhD student in German studies at the University of California, Berkeley. Also, you're the head of the Students for Justice in Palestine?
We actually don't have offices.
No hierarchies, yeah. Well, that's actually nice. Those are the clubs that I always liked, is the non-hierarchical ones. The anarchist in me comes out. Kumars, let's talk to you for a minute here about your involvement in the club, and how would you describe the people? What is the so-called BDS movement really about? The boycott, divestment, sanctions, right? It comes out, you know, 170 Palestinian organizations, you know, had a call for this, you know, 9 years ago. Tell our listeners, what exactly is this and what's the purpose and how did you get involved on campus?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. The BDS movement is a global nonviolent movement in solidarity with Palestinians. It was called for, as you mentioned, by Palestinian civil society organizations. Basically, boycott, divestment, and sanctions are intended to be mechanisms that put pressure on Israel, both the state and its economy, which of course are very closely linked. Israel has repeatedly shown that no form of international pressure from a group like the UN or human rights groups will actually drive it to change its policies. Certainly that pressure isn't coming from the US, where it might actually be effective. So it's really up to the real international community, which is ordinary people of conscience around the world, and in particular in the West, where Israel gets so much of its support, to advocate for cutting financial ties with Israeli corporations and the government of Israel. That's the divestment part. Boycott is simply not buying products or preventing products from being distributed and sold, as in the recent port blockades in the Bay Area and elsewhere on the West Coast.
And you had some involvement in the port blockades, but we'll come to that later on in the program. But go ahead.
Right. And so the last part of it, sanctions, is something that hasn't really happened yet. Sanctions obviously are financial or diplomatic penalties that are leveled against national governments by other national governments. This is part of what ultimately broke the back of the apartheid South African government.
Yes.
And it's on the horizon for us, even if it's not currently a reality. But basically, BDS is the most inclusive, the most representative strategy in terms of representing what the Palestinian people have called for showing support for Palestinian rights and for really changing the discourse in what many people would consider to be the belly of the beast, the United States.
Well, the number one recipient of U.S. foreign aid is Israel, and the top 10 recipients of U.S. foreign aid all practice torture or other dubious actions. In the case of Israel, of course, occupation
and torture.
Murder, torture. I mean, look, we could run down a long list of what's going on there. And of course, Nora Barrows Friedman, your book was likely already at the publisher when some of the recent attacks of summer came on.
I actually finished my introduction the week before the three Israeli youth were found murdered. And then, you know, these incredibly violent, horrifying attacks against Palestinians in Jerusalem, including the kidnapping and torture and murder by fire of the young Abu Khader in Shofat in Jerusalem. And then, of course, a couple weeks later, Israel started bombing Gaza and 2,200 people were killed, 500 of whom are children, thousands and thousands wounded. And I read somewhere that there are now 4 million tons of rubble in Gaza. That entire city blocks were just decimated.
And there's nothing in the U.S. corporate press about this wanton destruction, only calls for Israel to have a right to defend itself.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because there was quite a lot of coverage that I saw in the corporate media. But again, it was through this
lens.
Through
the frame and the lens.
Exactly.
Right.
And, you know, Palestinian families were being slaughtered, and there was no mention of their names or, you know, where they lived or how they lived their lives. It was all very predictable.
Like Wolf Blitzer in his AIPAC background on CNN, like wandering through the alleged tunnels of terrorists.
Right.
Like he's like he was Geraldo Rivera in Al Capone's vault or something. I mean, it was disgusting,
sick.
Sensationalistic, yellow tabloid journalism over at the most trusted name in news. It was actually riveting. I remember we were actually in Washington, D.C. at the time, and we're on Abby Martin's program. And you know, I just remember that that just came up, and you know, the imagery of it. And it was almost speechless to see that the degree to which these powers that be in the corporate state will go to merge to propagate this literal kind of propaganda.
Right. And then you see what happens afterwards. You know, now the Electronic Intifada's Ali Abonima just published something a couple weeks ago about now it's happening in Gaza in the so-called reconstruction era, where it's actually a real disaster capitalism and shock doctrine that's taking place, where Israel is actually going to be making a ton of money off of the reconstruction efforts. And not only that, but people who want to rebuild their homes will have to apply on an individual basis. I think they have to go through a four-step process in order to get one bag of cement. And in return, they will have the coordinates of their house retained and given to the Israeli government. There are no words to describe how horrifying the ramifications of Israeli policy can be. And of course, now is the time when BDS, when the boycott movement, is stepping up and stepping in and saying, you know, we can't hope for American politicians or Israeli politicians to just do the right thing anymore. We have to step in as civil society, as people of conscience, and, you know, really put wrenches into the economic system that make people's lives absolutely miserable.
Well, certainly in the United States, that's the one thing that, in fact, that's one of the only things that has consistently changed or challenged the status quo, and that is mass movements of people literally taking to the streets, putting as Mario Savio said, you know, putting your bodies and the gears of the machine.
Right.
That's very, very significant. Yeah. Well, it's another thing, too, that I have to say that I like about the book and your approach at the outset. We'll be back after this short break. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Nora Barros Friedman, author of this new book now just out from Just World Books. Nora is our guest for the hour today. The book is called In Our Power, and we certainly urge you to check it out. U.S. Students Organize for Justice in Palestine. We are also joined by Kumar Salehi, a PhD student in German Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, also a member of the Students for Justice in Palestine. And that's the practice what you preach part that I wanted to bring up here, is that you talk about this in the beginning of the book. You talk about how there are an awful lot of people over the years that help try to provide a voice for people in Palestine. Mm-hmm. But what you wanted to do is really go out and find the voice.
The voices are there.
Yeah.
The voices are loud. The voices are just not being listened to, or they're being actively suppressed and censored, especially on this issue. You know, as we know, Palestinians in Palestine and in the diaspora are consistently censored and silenced. And so I wanted this book to be really a vehicle for the amplification of the voices who have been out there for decades and, you know, actually over a century of Palestine organizing in this country. And so, yeah, I mean, I went around the country in 2013 and earlier this year, and I met up with about 70 different students across 30 different universities in almost a dozen states. And it wasn't a very scientific survey. You know, I wasn't going in to find, you know, X number of people from certain demographics. It was just people who happened to respond to my email or, you know, my calls. And I went out and I met them in their own communities, on their own campuses, I was connected with other students through them. And, you know, I tried as much as I could to turn this into a really non-analytical, non-scholarly, you know, analysis of this movement itself, but really let those students speak from their own experiences. You know, I'm really proud of them, and I was incredibly honored to be able to weave this book together with all these incredible voices.
And we definitely urge people to pick it up. That's, again, another compelling thing that makes it, you know, it's a fascinating read because of the diversity of voices, right? You have so many different people that you're talking to mm-hmm. about this issue, and you're all bringing it together, right, around this boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, which, by the way, as you also note, this movement has gotten some boost and support by academic organizations, by some fairly big name people.
American Studies Association, for one, the Native American and Indigenous Studies Association, the Asian American Studies Association. There's so many academic and scholarly organizations that are also signing on to the academic boycott call, you know, saying that they won't host academic institutional collaboration between their departments and Israeli universities, for example. It's really got so much momentum behind it. And again, the students are the ones powering it.
And that's, again, really a compelling angle for the book. And Kumar Salehi, let's bring you back into the conversation. Talk to us a little bit about, again, your involvement in Students for Justice in Palestine. And then you had mentioned that, speaking of boycott, you were involved in a massive action in Oakland that prevented a major Israeli ship from coming to port.
Yeah, the Block the Boat action. That was just this past August. On August 16th, there was the first of a series of actions, direct actions at the port, where a group of activists under the banner of the Block the Boat Coalition organized to picket the port of Oakland, where the largest Israeli shipping company, Zim Integrated Shipping, was going to make its sort of scheduled delivery. On the first day, Zim didn't even try to dock because we had thousands of people turn up to block this boat and prevent it from unloading. Over the course of the next 4 days, we came back every morning, 5 a.m., every night, 5 p.m. And in the end, Zim was barely able to unload anything. And now what we're hearing from all of our sources is that Zim is done bringing cargo to the Bay Area. And they claim it's not because of us, but who's going to believe that?
That's their saving face measure, I suppose. But that was a pretty significant action.
Yeah, it was the first time that anyone had prevented an Israeli ship from unloading for 2 days in a row. It had happened once before in 2010. But it was in response to a call actually by a Palestinian trade union in order to get workers around the world, in particular longshoremen, dock workers, to not facilitate Israel's global repression industry. Zim is actually essential in maintaining Israel's national security. They have to keep 11 ships for the Israeli government's use at all times. And they also bring in, especially to the port in Georgia, a lot of the ammunition that is Israeli made, and it's brought by this Israeli ship to America, where police departments from Missouri to California will use it to basically slaughter black and brown people here, just as those same bullets are used to kill Palestinians with impunity by Israel.
Yeah, and again, that's some serious global solidarity on this issue, right? And that's also very heartening to see that kind of spirit is still alive and well, particularly when it matters, right? And again, people weren't able to stop the slaughter that took place over this summer. But it's very important that people are still standing up to try to stop wherever this type of repressive force is rearing its head.
Yeah, I mean, Block the Boat definitely emerged out of the fury and outrage that we were all feeling. At this point, a lot of the major marches in big cities had already taken place. And I wasn't living in California at the time, but the group of people that I've now come to think of as my friends and certainly my comrades went. Really, I think they outdid themselves in trying to figure out a way to take direct action for Palestine to the next level. And it inspired similar protests in other West Coast ports. There's talk of now it spreading even to Savannah, Georgia, which is the really important one for stopping the flow of Israeli ammunition to U.S. police departments. But it's really the efficacy of it and the vision, I think the creativity behind direct action like Block the Boat that drew me to it, that made me realize immediately before I even moved to the Bay Area that I wanted to be a part of that.
That's fascinating. And Nora, you may recall this. Wasn't the police chief in Philadelphia recently in Israel?
Yeah, I mean, that happens all the time.
Yeah, right.
Oakland Police Department, LAPD, yes. I believe even Ferguson PD, if I'm not mistaken, have all been either on junkets to Israel or have had training by Israeli police forces here in the United States. I mean, that's been happening for decades.
Can you elaborate on it even just briefly? What's going on with that?
It's just a matter of the really tight-knit relationship between the U.S. and Israel.
Type of training?
Yeah. I mean, they call it like counterinsurgency or counterterrorism training. What's there to say?
Wanton violence and state
absolutely.
Repression training. But that's – yes. That's,
exactly.
They have their own name for it.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, that's really it. There's – you know, just as politicians want to make a name for themselves by pandering to the Israel lobby – and accepting money from them, the same thing is happening with police departments. They're accepting and celebrating the trainings that they are collaborating in with the Israeli security, so-called security forces, militias, to repress and suppress and murder and terrorize communities of color here in the U.S.
And we just did a show on this 2 weeks ago on 1033's paramilitarization of the police, so-called justifiable homicides, mm-hmm. and so on. We actually have several – have a chapter and several stories in the new censored book 2015 about that very issue. And you know, Peter Phillips, who isn't with us today as my usual co-host, he's been connecting the whole global war on terrorism to this domestic policing issue.
Yeah.
And you know, the cracking down on yeah. people in our own communities with this kind of mentality.
When you see how Israeli police or Israeli soldiers, occupation forces behave toward indigenous Palestinians, you know, anywhere, you know, inside the West Bank and Gaza Strip, including East Jerusalem and inside present-day Israel, there are incredibly stark similarities in the way that police forces treat, again, communities of color and poor people here in this country.
There's definitely a connection there that needs to be made and vocalized, yeah. right? So we can hear, see, think about these kinds of things. You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff, and we are in conversation today with author and journalist Nora Barros Friedman. Her new book is out now. It's on Just World Books. It's called In Our Power, U.S. Students Organize for Justice in Palestine. And we're also joined by Kumar Salehi, PhD student in German studies at the California University at Berkeley, also a member of the Students for Justice in Palestine. And of course, that's one of the big focal points of Nora's new book, literally going and talking to and having the voice of students involved in this social justice movement tell their stories. And Nora, in the beginning, you talk about how the book is, there's 10 chapters. It's sort of divided in a few sections with historical background. The historical background in the beginning is just so relevant. And so many people I know don't even know the truncated version that you're providing for the reader here. But it really sets the tone of the rest of the book. And you say in your intro that the most moving parts of the book for you come later on, mm-hmm. right, in the later chapters. Can you talk to us a little bit about why that is and what's going on by the time you're getting through this journey in your book?
The book kind of takes you on a journey from, you know, historical precedent that this movement has set and also, you know, the challenges that have come up for student activists because of Israel lobby organizations and Israel-aligned political groups trying to step in and silence them. There's a chapter just on the BDS movement alone. There's another chapter on the academic freedom boycott and academic boycott. And then the last few chapters are really about kind of the personal experiences and identities of the students themselves. And chapter 7 talks about the intersectionality of this movement with other movements for justice and human rights. So you have students – I met with students in Arizona and New Mexico, for example, who were joining up with local indigenous and Latino and Chicano organizations organizing against Obama's deportation industry or trying to get people out of ICE detention centers, struggling for the rights of Latinos and undocumented persons along the U.S. border states. And of course, there's also literal intersections as well. There's the U.S.-Mexico border wall, this giant militarized structure. One of the contractors for that wall is Elbit Systems, which is an Israeli contracting company, which has had a major hand in building Israel's wall in the West Bank, which is annexed and stolen land from Palestinians, continues every day. So students are making those connections, as well as students who are involved in queer liberation and women's liberation and black liberation, students who are involved in labor struggles. There's so many different ways that Palestine solidarity organizing is connected to other movements of universal human rights and justice. That was really moving to see that students are not just focused on one single issue, that they're actually incorporating their activism into local and national and international struggles as well. And then the last couple chapters are really about themselves talking about their identities and their relationship to this movement. And the last question that I asked a lot of my students when I was interviewing them was, what does solidarity mean to you? And which is a really kind of hard question to answer. And I was expecting a lot of challenging answer, like, oh, I don't know how to answer. But everyone across the board who I asked that to had incredibly moving, incredibly articulate and eloquent answers to that. One of the students I spoke with, Rebecca Pierce, who graduated from UC Santa Cruz, mm-hmm. when I asked her what her definition of solidarity is, she said, quote, "For me, the question of what is solidarity in terms of Palestine has really changed as I've been involved. In the beginning, I thought I would come here and say what Israel is doing in the West Bank and Gaza is wrong. Over time, it became about understanding the Palestinian narrative and connecting it to my own struggle and saying that not only am I condemning Israel, but I'm standing here in support of the Palestinians for the demands that they're making. It's not about my feelings necessarily, but it's about supporting them in their moment of need. I think that on campus it started out as the same. It was at first condemning the way that the school is treating Palestinians or Muslims, and then it became your struggle is our struggle too. For me, that was a really beautiful moment, and it showed me how I wanted to be in solidarity with people. I had experienced solidarity in a really powerful way myself." That was actually from one of the long-form interviews. So I have like 63 interviews altogether, and about 10 of them I kind of pulled out and put them in between the chapters themselves so that students could really talk in depth about their experiences. And they're all very different and from different backgrounds, but very incredibly just moving, beautiful people.
When you're talking, of course, it's interesting you're going into this thinking this is a complicated kind of question, but because of their students, because of their connection, because they were living this solidarity, mm-hmm. it was actually an innate response. It kind of mm-hmm. sounds like it just came out.
Yeah, and I think that's one of, Kumars, you can talk to this as well. Like, I feel like the meetings that I've been able and honored to sit in on of SJP chapters around the country, it's not just like, okay, on Tuesday we're going to do this and we're going to, mm-hmm. We have to call this administrator and blah, blah, blah. It's really like people are talking very openly and very candidly about their own personal identities in relationship to this movement and how best to, how to become a better activist, a better listener, a better friend. For you, what does solidarity mean?
My sort of way into this is just that my parents are from Iran. I grew up with vague sense of the injustice that is being done to Palestinians. But of course, as a kid, you don't know anything about politics necessarily. Nonetheless, the seeds of it were planted. And my mom was actually in something of a Palestine solidarity activist. Later on, I came to realize actually how deeply it had been imprinted on me. In high school, I did anti-war protests, but as the movement sort of fizzled out after Obama was elected, it seemed like people who wanted to resist imperialism and address global racial justice issues that the U.S. is complicit in didn't have anywhere to go. Turns out they didn't have anywhere to go but SJP. And it took me a while, but I also eventually found my way back to activism. And when I went to NYU, New York University, for grad school, I joined the chapter of SJP there, and it changed my life. It was a growing chapter, not one that had historically had big victories, but a really great, diverse, organic group of people came together, and by the end of it, we were making national news headlines for carrying out mock eviction, a notice action, and then being called out on every right-wing publication imaginable.
Well, you've made it.
Yeah, right? And so I knew that I was going to continue that here. I think that in particular, people are seeing, this is something that I sense very strongly, the idea that Palestine is an issue of U.S. imperialism as well as simply a global human rights issue has become so much more widely accepted. It's not necessarily that I think this is a good thing it took this long, but certainly the attack on Gaza this summer, I think, made it click for a lot of people. A lot of people that are uncritical of the president started holding him responsible for what his ally government was doing. I think that for me, I see that this is an issue where so many people in my community, generally progressive people, educated people, are not as progressive as they should be.
Progressive, but Palestine.
Progressive, except for Palestine.
Including Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren. Yeah. These paragons of the alleged progressive left, or what remains of it in the confines of the corporatist Democratic Party, they were conspicuously silent
openly supportive.
Right. At first, there was Sanders wouldn't answer questions, and then, of course, they come out. That's a serious phenomenon here in establishment politics in the United States.
It really is, and I think that it is one of the reasons why people are often so in the dark about the reality of the issues, because in American political discourse, when an issue is completely bipartisan, that means that it's never discussed or never in a substantive way. And I see that among American leftists, among dissidents, among people that want to really change the paradigm that average people approach politics with, Palestine has become a banner under which those people can declare that even the people that are excluded from the conversation, especially the people that are excluded from the conversation, I advocate for them. I'm not Palestinian. A lot of people assume that I am because I'm involved in this work and I have a funny name. and it's not about that. It's not at all about my identity as an Iranian American. It's not about a religious identity. It's not even primarily for me a matter of my responsibility as an American. It's what Martin Luther King said, an injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And to be able to stand up and say that on this issue, there is no balance. The nuances are only the nuances of how it is that Israel is able to carry out this horrific system of apartheid. The nuances are not, this isn't black and white. Absolutely, it's black and white.
Yeah. And that needs to be pointed out, really in a place like the United States, where, as you said, there's great consensus sort of in the establishment about, how could you possibly question what's happening in this part of the world? And you just nailed it. An injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And that gets to the title of the book, Nora, In Our Power. How did you come up with that title?
It was actually pulled from a quote from one of the interviews that I did with this brilliant young woman. I think she was 18 years old at Brooklyn College, Sarah Ali. And she said, it was along the lines, she was talking about, people say that this kind of work can't be done or that we won't have any successes, but it's in our power to do so, to make change for social justice. And I just thought that was like a brilliant way to kind of encapsulate this movement, that these students, they're optimistic, but it's not a naive optimism. They know that they are just a small part of how Palestinians are going to liberate themselves, that they are standing in solidarity with Palestinians who are in the process of liberation, but that it's not like we can't do anything. The students are incredibly organized, they're incredibly determined, and they're so strong, and they're not backing down. They have been through so many challenges off campus and on campus, and they're still, gaining supporters and gaining members.
Yeah, again, it's pretty remarkable, and you write about that in the beginning of the book. And I would love it if you would possibly share with us one more piece of the interviews. I mean, you have so many people that you talk to, what's one other one that really stands out to you? Because it's so powerful and moving when we hear these people, again, in their own words.
So here's Omar Shaker, who was at Stanford Law. Omar said that he and his fellow student activists used to joke that more than 75% of their time was centered on student organizing, even though they're paying an extraordinary amount of tuition to be there. He said, that's all to say that anyone who's involved in this movement has skin in the game. It would have been easier not to be an activist, he said. It would have been easier to do almost anything else. It's not just in terms of your academic career, but also families, even coming from a family that is Muslim or Arab in my case, or for other members who are Palestinian. Many families encourage their children to just focus on their own careers and not get involved in activism. So I think we all feel a sense of being in this together. In 2010, Shaker traveled to the West Bank with a richly diverse group of about 8 student organizers from colleges on the East Coast and the West Coast, from different genders and ancestral backgrounds. Quote, at one point we went to the separation wall with a can of spray paint, and we spray painted reunion in a liberated Jerusalem in 2030. We all made a pact together that we were going to work to end the occupation and to have a Jerusalem in a liberated land where everyone was treated equally. We are all committed to that. We put that on the wall and took a picture, and all of us check in every year to see how we're all working to get toward that goal.
We'll be back after this short break. You're tuned to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. You're listening to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff. Today's subject, Palestine, and more particularly, we've been talking about Nora Barros Friedman's new book, In Our Power. It's just out from Just World Books, In Our Power, U.S. Students Organize for Justice in Palestine. We are also joined by Kumar Salehi, a PhD student in German Studies at the University of California, Berkeley, a member of Students for Justice in Palestine. And Kumar, let's turn to you and let's get into some more detail. Describe for our listeners, what is it that students are doing on campuses like the University of California, Berkeley, and talk a little bit about some of the challenges you face or some of the specific instances of what kind of resistance you're facing on a campus of allegedly, again, a higher education learning institution, but you're running into some things that maybe are less collegial.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much across the board, we encounter resistance. I mean, the initiatives that have generally been undertaken for BDS on campuses have had to do with the divestment, so the removal of investment from Israeli companies. These are investments that the administration can have in terms of faculty pensions, in terms of other direct investments. And 5 of the UC campuses have actually voted, their student governments have voted to divest from corporations that profit from the Israeli occupation of Palestine. Every time there is a campaign to pass a divestment resolution at any campus, not just in California, there is incredible external opposition. Zionist organizations, including the Anti-Defamation League, not only do they pressure the university establishment, which, as you can imagine, is not very difficult. They also actually send people to campuses the day of, leading up to these votes, in order to, I mean, sometimes they like give away free pizza, but it's a propaganda effort because they know that the momentum is with Palestine solidarity and BDS on campus. They vilify campuses as places that are havens for what they call anti-Semitism, or, you know, sort of anti-Israel bias, as they would say.
Does any of this rise to the level in your experience of intimidation or threatening behavior?
Yeah, I mean, it can
get pretty
ugly.
Or at least the former, if not the latter.
It can get pretty ugly. I've heard that at Berkeley there have been incidents in the past of actual physical assaults against SJP members by Zionist students that were basically not taken seriously by campus law enforcement. I know that we would get a lot of harassment at NYU SJP on the street, but in particular, we faced administrative repression as well as repression from other students when we carried out an action that really ruffled some feathers. We distributed mock eviction notices, so eviction notices that call attention to and sort of try to ape the style of the real eviction notices that Palestinians receive on a regular basis from the Israeli army, with no cause, no justification. Your house is being demolished. You have an hour.
Happens all the time.
It happens all the time.
In Palestine.
In occupied Palestine, in East Jerusalem, actually also in what's called Israel proper. We were trying to do a creative and striking action that would call attention to this. We distributed it to every door on every floor of two of the largest dorms on campus. The next day, a blog post goes up written by an NYU student who was a member of the AIPAC affiliate. That's the big right-wing Zionist lobby, the affiliate of AIPAC at NYU, made up of students. And so this student wrote a blog post on the website, news website Times of Israel, accusing us of targeting Jewish students, of distributing anti-Semitic flyers, and basically calling for disciplinary action against us. This call was taken up by a representative of the Anti-Defamation League. It was taken up by a local assembly person.
It generated a lot of attention.
Dove Hykind, yeah. And her claims of targeting Jewish students were parroted by publications from the National Review to more mainstream outlets.
So simply put, was that the case?
It simply wasn't the case. All we had written on those flyers was basic information about the process of ethnic cleansing that was happening in the West Bank.
If you lived there, this is what you might wake up to.
Precisely. And moreover, the flyers were clearly marked as fake.
Raising awareness.
Yeah. The complaint that we had sort of like made Jewish students uncomfortable, it was rather unfounded, I think, because I think that it should only make you uncomfortable when people point this out if you personally identify with the sort of violence that Palestinians
One would hope
suffer.
That one would feel uncomfortable about the actions taking place.
Right, right.
Given, you know, the politics of what you're calling out, right? This is not a personal
exactly
threat to people living in the dormitory. This is a, hey, imagine, if you will, this is you. And this is what you're waking up to. This is what you're not seeing about our perspective.
Exactly. And so, but Zionist groups, including external groups, launched a campaign basically to pressure the administration to punish us. Earlier that spring, Northeastern University's chapter of SJP had actually been suspended for carrying out that very same action. They were suspended for a month. We looked into the legalities and the specificities of the rules in light of that suspension and managed to avoid actually committing punishable infractions.
Well, these are actually, they're, you know, free speech codes on campus are regularly challenged. I know the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Greg Lukianoff, this organization back east, they routinely challenge speech codes on campus because there is no right to not be made uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, free speech is designed sometimes purposely to make people feel uncomfortable, to get across a point, or to get people to see a particular perspective that they are shielded from elsewhere.
Yeah. And so the administration didn't have anything really to go on. But because they were getting so much pressure from Zionist students and presumably from much wealthier donors, they had to do something. So they had to make a show of investigating us even before they had communicated with us. So it was even leaked. We had to read in a news article that the administration was looking into our action as a judicial matter. They did not communicate that with us. We, however, launched a, I think, pretty effective media campaign to counter all of the smears that were being repeated about us. Students trying to get us suspended took to Fox News not once but twice in the span of a month. And members, including myself, began receiving harassing. I got harassing phone calls for a week. A female student received violent and sort of sexual messages. My. It was very clear that the only people on campus being made to feel uncomfortable for who they are was us, actually. It was people advocating Palestinian rights. And the idea that our action was an impediment to dialogue, that it shut down the possibility of dialogue by alienating Jewish students, that idea was taken up also by the administration.
Although it seems like the very people shutting it down were the other, were these
yeah.
other people.
I mean, in fact, I remember
refusing to have the dialogue.
Yeah. On that same day after the action had taken place, I heard people on the street discussing our action, like, hey, did you get one of those notices? And people didn't really seem to be disturbed or mad. They thought it was interesting.
The checkpoint, the mock checkpoints, like at Columbia, Noro has a photo in her book. That's a very powerful one because a lot of people don't understand that Palestinians are subject to checkpoints, right? Where they have to prepare IDs and permits, open the trunks of their cars, hand over the keys, lift up their clothing. I mean,
yeah,
this is like routine.
There is no constitution for Palestinians. Like, their rights are violated all the time. And all we wanted to do was bring those voices that are so clearly crying out for justice and have those voices be heard, actually, on campus. There was more discussion of Israel-Palestine, in particular the Palestinian perspective, on campus than ever before after we did that action. So it was particularly ironic that the university felt the need to make a show of investigating us.
It's also the case that it appears that university officials are unaware that their reaction to pressures is creating pretty much what you were trying to do anyway, but you were trying to do it in a way that says, let's sit down, let's talk about this. This is what life is like for people here, and this should be a great place to start, walking a mile in someone else's shoes. Empathy, right? And the mock checkpoints, these, I mean, this direct action, it's very clever, and it's also a long-standing tradition in free societies that we can use these means of expression and creativity to get people to consider ideas that are beyond their own.
Yeah. And I mean, there are other avenues as well. Direct action is one. The actual hard work of getting boycott and divestment resolutions passed in institutions is an equally important, if not more, aspect of that. Currently, what CalISJP is working very hard on, and this is something that I think it would be really important just for listeners to know, is our grad student union for the entirety of the UC system is considering a full membership vote, is considering a boycott and divestment resolution. This would make it the first union in the United States to endorse BDS. And it would basically require that all funds be divested from Israeli companies, as well as it would call on UAW International, the United Auto Workers, to divest completely, call on the United States government to divest completely. We are getting a lot of resistance, not from Berkeley campus, but from other campuses. Mm-hmm. But the vote is taking place December 4th. We are, you know, also launching a media campaign. It would be historic. There is a lot of opposition on other campuses, particularly UCLA and Irvine. But I think we're up to the challenge, and the full strength of SJP and other grad students is behind this initiative.
Kumar Salehi, PhD student, German studies at Cal Berkeley, student for Justice in Palestine. Can you give a website where people can get maybe more information about SJP and this upcoming action and so forth at Cal for December?
Sure. You can follow us on Facebook at Students for Justice in Palestine at Berkeley. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm currently the SJP Twitter at Kumar Salehi, K-U-M-A-R-S-S-A-L-E-H-I. Hopefully our club Twitter will be up and running soon. But in the meantime, basically, to get more information about this vote, the union vote, just look up UAW 2865. Okay. That's the union, and the vote is December 4th. We will be in your newspapers and on the internet.
We'll be back after this short break. You're tuned to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. Our guest today has been author Nora Barros Friedman and also Kumar Salehi, PhD student, German Studies at California University, Berkeley, also a member of Students for Justice in Palestine. Nora Barros Friedman, this book goes from, you know, connecting the dots with Trayvon Martin and fighting institutional racism, the challenging, you know, the censorship of the corporate state and sort of the hegemonic rule from the United States and Israel through NATO. I mean, it's not just Palestine, though your focus is clearly on the Palestinian struggle. But, you know, again, going through the book here, so many other examples of injustices just spring forward. So that other concept of solidarity, how all of these issues are related, again, incredibly, incredibly powerful, incredibly well put together book. And I would also say a pretty quick read. It's very, very well written.
Thank you.
What a great narrative voice, certainly, that you have, Nora Barros Friedman. The book is In Our Power, and it's out by Just World Books. You can learn more about them at justworldbooks.com. In Our Power, U.S. Students Organize for Justice in Palestine. Our guest today has been author Nora Barros Friedman and also Kumar Salehi, PhD student, German Studies at California University, Berkeley, also a member of Students for Justice in Palestine. Nora, thanks so much. Kumar, thanks so much for joining us today. But last word, Nora, I want you to have the last word about what you really hope is going to come out of this book. Then tell people where they can follow you online and how they can get involved.
What I want people to get out of this is really to kind of put faces and names to student activism, especially on this issue, especially when it comes to Palestine. I think activists and Palestinians themselves are painted with these really stereotypical and generalized brushes. And this is an incredible student movement in the great traditions of all student-led movements for social change and civil rights. And it's, you know, I put some history in there, but I don't bombard my readers with it. So, you know, people who haven't read anything about Palestine can learn a little bit of the context of why students are organizing for justice there. And I'm really looking forward to feedback. And, you know, I wish that I could start on book number two. I mean, just in the last year, I've met like dozens and dozens and dozens of new students who I wish I could travel back in time and interview for this book, but maybe that'll be book number two.
That's fantastic, Nora. And that's how the process goes.
Yeah.
And the grass doesn't grow long under your feet. We know that. Thanks so much for taking time out. Congratulations on your book, In Our Power, U.S. Students Organize for Justice in Palestine. You can, again, learn more at Just World Books website. That's justworldbooks.com, .org.
I think it's .org.
Yeah, .org.
And I'm on Twitter at NoraBF.
Right on. Nora, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Kumars, thank you again for coming.
Thank you.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaigns.
You're tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and to Erica Bridgman at the controls. The Project Censored Show airs on close to 20 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org.
An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of the brothers and our sisters. By criminal minds, political ties, habitual lies, alibis, guys, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse.
apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide wars fall for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons filled with capacity citizens. And the times for the master thief. Confine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu.
We got that love with our brothers and our sisters.